Mr. Hayward, Reel 14. I think we've got to the point where you just described the situation with regard to infantry on Hill 112. What about, was that the end of the day for you?
That was the end of the day. We would hang on to the position on that hill after that battle for the rest of the day and then simply go back to the Mount Carver, which for us, I think, was the last of it, the last of that.
You mentioned that you'd be doing maintenance in the tank lager. What sort of maintenance would you do?
It would be very, very basic. Just having a general run around the tank, see if the tracks needed adjusting or anything needing topping up oil levels. There were other things inside the tank that each individual crew member had to keep an eye on. His own particular area of the tank, like the radio operator, so on. The gunner, you know, with his ammunition, he would have to check that. And I would even have to see that I still got an adequate supply of machine gun ammunition, which was usually in a tin box, in rolled up in a belt. It would be a belt of ammunition.
And what about yourself? You've been in action a couple more days now. Was it getting easier or more difficult, or how are you feeling?
I would say that at that time, even though I was still very young, I would be feeling very tired and very grubby. Not much opportunity to have a decent wash during those battle days. Perhaps not necessarily very hungry, because we had modest supplies of sweets and vitamin pills and things like that, and hard-tack biscuits to chew away at during the day if there was a lull in the fighting. So by the time it got round to having a proper meal, we'd be ready for one, but not particularly desperately hungry.
And what happened next then? Because that was the end of that battle for you.
Yes, well, there was a point at which somebody, the powers that be, would say, well, we're not getting anywhere here, and somebody else would go in and hold the line. But I think from the record, if you bear in mind that we wouldn't know this at the time, the officers would not know it, but we crew would probably not know that we were in a sort of a salient, and we were at the tip of this salient. And because of the pressure from the Germans on each side of this salient, it was becoming untenable. So we virtually came out and simply for a few days, until the preparations began for Goodwood, we'd be simply used in a holding position, just keeping a watchful eye on one particular area of the front line, which wasn't particularly under fire. There were duties to perform. There would be occasional shooting here and there, but not in the form of a major battle, just the individual actions on the part of a tank that had spotted something. And this went on for several days, with squadrons being changed about, relieved, you know, one squadron would relieve another. And it must have been, I've got here, it must have been very soon after the 112 battle that I was transferred to another troop leader's tank. This time it was a honey, a Stuart, in the recce troop. So in that one move, I was being taken out of B squadron and back into HQ squadron, where I'd been in the workshops This particular honey, the troop leader of this tent was Sergeant Bill Scott, who lives now in Dumfries.
Now, according to the official history, they got the honey sometime around the 14th of July, which is different from what it says in Sellers. And it might fit in better with your memories as well, because I know there's a slight conflict. During this time, and that's dated the 14th, so between the 7th and the 14th, it looks likely they got them. What could you describe the honey tank?
Yes, it seemed a tall, rather top-heavy looking tank. Very ungainly looking, but it was mounted on tracks that were smaller and not so long as the Sherman, and it was driven by a radial engine, which is rather like the old aircraft engines that used to be exposed on the front of an aircraft, with sort of five or six cylinders in a circle. And so it was, in effect, a type of aircraft engine that was driving this honey or Stewart tank. And you could get at the engine by opening some rather like house doors at the back, two hinged doors, which opened up to reveal the engine, which was standing on end, like an aircraft engine does. It was standing on the base of the circle, as you might say. Quite interesting. Made a different sound to a Sherman tank. But the honey tank, I've forgotten whether it had a crew of five or four. I would say that because it was smaller, they must have managed with a crew of four. But there was still a co-driver with the driver, and that's what I was, a co-driver, with a machine gun again, which I was used to. But the turret on the honey tank only had a 37mm gun, which was, to my memory, I can't remember that being used much, because it couldn't do as much damage. So it could, for instance, shoot up stuff there quite easily. But if you started firing at another tank, like a German tank, it would just bounce off and be completely useless. So I think it was very rarely used, otherwise it would have attracted too much attention from the enemy's side. So if we used anything, it would be the machine gun, and I don't remember using that a lot, if at all. But what was used a lot on the heli tank was the smoke, because being in a forward position often, doing reconnaissance, we would often find ourselves in a tight spot, getting too close to the enemy, perhaps surprising them, but it would be wise to get out of that situation quickly with such a lightly armoured tank. And so the trick was to fire smoke and get the other members of the troop to do the same and make a screen, which was quite effective. I remember them doing this quite well. And we would retreat under cover of the smoke into a safer area. So we were used in that position, and I've said here that As I remember trailing around in this honey tank, which still had the turret on, for quite a number of days, my guess is that I was transferred almost immediately into the wrecking troop after the Schur campaign had fizzled out. So that would be quite early on in July.
Now, just one thing I want to pick up, but before I go on, your experience of driving the Sherman, because you only had one, now, and that was before you went into battle at Shirt. Could, just to drop that in, what was it like to drive it then? Because it was your only time of...
Yes, it didn't appear to me to be any different to driving a tank in my Catterick days. It seemed to have the usual type of controls.
What were they? Just run through them on the show.
Two levers, touch on the steering and the braking of the tracks.
Any other controls here? That two, one on either side. And what else? Any other sort of brakes?
There would be. Yes, but driving a tank, we were accustomed to not having any brakes as such on the tank. The levers would brake the tracks. If you wanted to stop, you would simply pull both levers back at once. If you wanted to turn, you'd pull either left or right. You'd have a clutch pedal.
What was that for?
Well, you had gears. You had gears on the tank, so you'd have a clutch pedal and a gear lever. But things like a modern car with all these instruments on the panel, I don't remember anything elaborate like that on a tank. There might be, I would think for the guess, there'd be something like an oil pressure gauge. There might even be a petrol indicator, but very basic. There'd be a switch for the engine. The clutch pedal, if you can call it that, I think would be more like an iron bar than a pedal. Like a twisted iron bar. So there was plenty of room wherever your foot was to get onto this clutch lever or pedal. Driving a Sherman tank, I would say, was just a little bit more luxurious than driving one of the basic tanks we had at Catterick, one of the old type tanks.
Now, what happened? Because there was an incident while you were driving. You had the crew aboard.
Yes. The officer was in charge in the turret.
That's Lieutenant Dark.
Lieutenant Dark. And he would certainly not be doing this in battle. He would be given the opportunity to drive before we went into battle to satisfy himself, no doubt, that I could do it in an emergency, although I wouldn't have been as efficient as the well-trained driver. But anyway, but why I deduced that this must have been at Cully, because we were going down a very narrow lane, and I've been back to Cully a couple of years ago, which was my first visit since Normandy days. And it still looks much the same in the sort of area where we were parked in these fields. And the lanes seem to be just as narrow. So it could have been that very lane that I motored along with my son-in-law, where he, at a certain point, he said, turn into this farmyard. And this lane was so narrow that you couldn't sort of guide the tank through this gateway, which was straight on the edge of the lane. You couldn't sort of swing around and do a sweeping curve into this gateway. The only way you could get in there was by yanking on the, say, right-hand lever to break that track, and letting the other track swing the tank round at a sharp right angle. But that proved impossible because there wasn't the room there to do that with such a huge tank to get through a farm gateway. And although I got the tank through in the process, it had gone over the width of the gate and I knocked one of the posts down going in. But that was a casualty of war at the time. In England, I expect the government would have had to have coughed up and replaced that had it happened.
Now, back to that was just a drop in, something I missed out. Now, what about this new tank you're in, the honey tank? Well, the crew, you mentioned Bill Scott. Was he the troop? He was the sergeant of your tank, was he? Or was he the troop?
He was the sergeant in charge. And
what was he like?
He was a very excitable chap. He probably wasn't much older than myself, possibly a year, something like that. But certainly around about the same age group, and very excitable. I think he'd been in the regiment since the beginning, and he was very regimental, proud.
Scottish.
Scottish, and he was at least intelligible. He wasn't his Scottish dialect. You could come to terms with it. It wasn't quite so severe as some of the Dundee boys. You could understand him quite easily.
In what way was he excitable? I mean, how did it show itself?
It showed itself because he always wanted to be in the forefront. He always wanted to be in the thick of anything that was going on. And consequently, he made us crew members quite uneasy at times as to what trouble he was going to get us into. Like the Sherman tank, the only other crew member I remember is the driver, who I understand was a chap called Spray. And
do you remember his first name?
I don't remember his first name. I did write to Bill Scott. I may have a letter somewhere in which he possibly mentions the other crew member. Somehow I can't visualise that three people got into the turret of a honey. I would think that the radio operator, or even the commander himself, had to act as gunner occasionally. This sometimes did happen in four-man tanks, where one crew member acted in dual capacity.
I'm a bit confused. Was Scott the tank commander, or was the officer in there as well?
Oh, no, the troop there was no officer there in that tank. There would be officers in other tanks, other honey tanks, but our particular troop leader was Sergeant Scott, in charge of that tank. And he would have probably two or three other tanks in his troop.
And so during this period, you were there, you were at Moray, Colville, mostly at Colville, and then moved up to Camilly just before Goodwood.
Yes.
Do you remember either of these places, Moray or Colville?
No. That's one of the things about Normandy. I'm always rather amused when I hear of people, some of our other soldiers saying they went round raiding houses for any wines left in the cellars and that sort of thing. Well, to my memory, we never got close enough to any villages to do that. We were always out in the open country. It was only later in the campaign where we actually seemed to actually go through villages, but I don't ever remember at that
So it does say just the area of Colville, so you were probably just near it all.
Near it, yes. Right.
Now, would you know why you were transferred to the reconnaissance troop?
I don't. This mystifies me. I thought at one time that it was punishment for the incident of the first day. And then I thought afterwards, well, he could have got rid of me then. At that stage, but then he put up with me for the rest of those battles and also commended me for good shooting in the Hill 112 battle. It struck me that perhaps a hole had to be filled in the recce troop, and they bear in mind that new tank crews were coming out from Britain to replace the ones we'd lost. And it may be that a kind of minor shuffle was going on all the time after these battles. And people who were considered to be more useful elsewhere would be put there and others take their place. Like, for instance, a properly trained tank driver might have taken my place in the Sherman. That could be the answer, because what encourages me to think that it wasn't through misdemeanors I was transferred was the fact that I was transferred to another troop leader's tank. I would think that a troop leader would be very uneasy about accepting somebody who'd been chucked out of another.
Now, the other one, members of your the tank commanders were Bert Noakes and Jock Byrne, according to your account. Do you remember either of those? These are the other troop, you know, the other tank commanders within Scott's troop.
Yes, I do remember them. Yes, whenever I see a photograph of the Reckie troop of those days, I can recognise them immediately. And they were, both of them were typical fighting force men of the early days. What I called a family regiment. They were part of that early contingent that formed the regiment and had become almost a family. The same with Bill Scott. He got us into one incident. We still had the turret in those days. To go back to your business about the turrets being removed on a certain date, I've gone through all the accounts I've been able to see of that period, and it seems to me, piecing it all together, that the turrets were not all removed together. They were removed at intervals. It was a steady campaign, and it was probably only one unit that could do a turret at a time, and it was going on over several days. So we still had our turrets until quite near to the assembly point for Goodwood.
Now, what were you doing during this period then?
Well, we were certainly doing a lot of reconnaissance, because I think this is probably where my memories of crossing these water lines is so vivid. The honey tank is a most ungainly vehicle to cross a steep-sided railway line, and it would scare anybody to death to be sitting in a tank doing that. And I'm sure the Beaverin did that on several days. It must have been something to do with the area that we were in, but every time we went out on an expedition of reconnaissance, to get to the area we were surveying, we probably had to cross these railway lines each day. And that's why it sticks in my memory. We'd all shudder whenever one of these embankments appeared in front of us, that we were going over one of those again.
So it was the same as for a Sherman, but even worse. You do remember, in your mind, you remember going over an embankment in a Sherman, though, as well?
Yes. I do think there was an occasion when we went over in the Sherman, but it sticks out more as a honey
problem
experience. Yes.
Now, what about it? How would you organise and go on a reconnaissance then? What would happen?
Well, it certainly seemed to be a much more speedy affair than creeping up to a battle front in a Sherman. The Sherman in the battle front area would just move around very, very slowly and not change its position much. But a hundred would gallop away, if that's the right expression, and would charge as quickly as possible into an area that was under scrutiny, and we'd all be scattered, the whole Reckie troop. I'm not sure how many ticks it was, the Reckie troop, and they have some figures here. Um, Recce troop, oh yes. Nominally had 11. It says here 3 by 3 plus 2. So that would be 3 troops of 3 then by the look of it, plus 2 in a sort of HQ situation.
Surely the recce troop was a troop. Wouldn't they wouldn't there be sections or something?
Yes, they described the whole thing as a troop. They called it the recce troop. I've never really thought about what they called each individual group of 3 tanks.
Must be written down somewhere.
There must be a name for it somewhere. I'll try and find out.
It doesn't matter. I mean, you can carry on. I know what you mean anyway. Perhaps if we use this example where Scott volunteered to, Sergeant Scott, to go and look for a tiger. If you tell that whole story, because that seems to be a typical...
Yes. Yes. On the other occasions when we were doing reconnaissance, I do remember that there were, scattered around us, there were the other Hunnies. And it's on those occasions when I remember us using smoke several times to conceal our retreat. From a hot spot. But when this volunteer business started to go and search for this tiger tank, at that time we were not out on reconnaissance. As far as I recall, we were sitting in a sort of rest position, not particularly near the front line, and this message came over from the commanding officer to the whole of the recce troop asking for volunteers. And the officer got me, heard him mutter, "I'm going to do this." And the rest of the crew said, "Oh, no, you're not. You shut up," or words to that effect. "We don't want to be involved with a tiger tank." And anyway, he got his way. He ignored us and just said he would volunteer, and he got his instructions as to where to go. And my memory tells me that none of the other recce troop came with us. We just went on our own. And I don't think it was particularly far away. I dimly remember crossing several fields. It might be further than I remember, but let's say perhaps a mile or two away. But anyway, we went off.
Now, you knew you were looking for a tiger. What was the reputation of the tiger then? Because they've built up a bit of a myth now, but what about then? I mean...
Well, then, they still... sort of the idea of a tiger, which we knew was one of their biggest and heavily armoured tanks, we had been told about. I think it was its firing power that we were scared of, that it could shoot us up at a tremendous distance. And obviously a shot from an 88mm gun would have blown us to smithereens in such a lightly armoured tank. And this, of course, horrified the crew, the thought that we could be shot at from a great distance before we even saw it, especially if it was well concealed.
Now, you've gone about a mile.
Yes, we'd gone about a mile away, I suppose, and we entered a wood. And at that stage, we were feeling our way very cautiously. And after a little while, we could see a cottage in the trees, almost surrounded by trees. There was very little open space around this cottage. And there was nothing visible as we approached this cottage. All seemed quiet there, no sign of any enemy, abandoned vehicles, or any sign of war at all around this area. But in the end, of course, we got right up to this cottage. By this time, we were all quaking because, with the aid of the cottage, anything could have been hidden. But nothing loath, the Bill Scott told the driver to edge up on the right hand side of this cottage. Now, the driver would be on the left, and the co-driver would be out on the right. So, with the aid of the periscope, the co-driver would be the first one to be able to see round that corner, because the turret was back, so the officer wouldn't. And the minute I got my periscope in the position where I could see round the corner, I could see a tank and this huge